Depression bites, depression eats.
The average consumption of meat per person in the United States in the period 1936 to 39 was 126 pounds a year.
This is America. I want a bowl of raw red meat right now. Forget about that. Bring me a live cow over to the table. I'll carve off what I want and ride the rest home. Dum da da dum da da dum.
125 pounds per person per year.
And all we're going to serve is raw meat right on the bone.
Now that's good.
For New York Mayor LaGuardia and comedian Dennis Leary, apparently, meat is comfort food. But all kinds of dishes have helped America get through hard times. A meaty look at depression cuisine then and now. That's good. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, food glory. It's food. It's Wednesday, May 13th. Food, besides meat, also. I'm John Hockenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, morning. We take a look today at the psychological stress on active duty soldiers in light of Monday's tragic shooting. We're also going to look ahead to the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing today on the so-called torture memos. And we continue with our look at graduation, looking at the challenges that college grads are facing in this economy. Those stories coming up, but first, these headlines.
And in the headlines, an Afghan lawmaker says 95 children were among the 140 people killed in a controversial U.S. Taliban battle in Farah province earlier this month. A U.S. spokesman says insurgents are responsible for the deaths because they forced villagers to remain in their homes during the fighting. The U.S. won't say how many people it thinks were killed in that same battle. In Bethlehem today, Pope Benedict underlined his support for the establishment of a Palestinian state. He spoke directly to a small delegation of Palestinian Catholics from Gaza.
I ask you to bring back to your families and your communities my warm embrace and my sorrow for the loss, the hardship, and the suffering you have had to endure.
The audience took place during a mass in Manger Square. The Pope also criticized a trade embargo in Gaza. Farai?
The European Union is fining chip manufacturer Intel a record $1.4 billion for anti-competitive behavior. Now, the EU says that the chip maker gave discounts to companies to buy all their chips from Intel and to delay the launch of computers based on chips made by rival AMD. NASA says damage caused to the shuttle Atlantis during its launch is not serious. Thermal tiles were probably scratched by debris during liftoff. The space shuttle Atlantis is expected to latch onto the Hubble Space Telescope today to begin a week's worth of repairs. And President Obama meets today with Senate leaders to discuss his nominee for the Supreme Court. We're going to talk about that later. And it's from his discussion on the matter, you know, far from the first one, he is looking at how to do a replacement for retiring Judge David Souter.
Biggest democracy in the world has phase five of its general election, 107 million people eligible to vote. The Dow and S&P mostly flat yesterday. The S&P starts trading at 9:08. 1.6 million people are graduating this year. That's the good news. The bad news, they're graduating into this economy. Are you one of them? What are you going to tell your grandchildren about these economic times we live in? Give some people from the future advice. Call us with your story of how you're handling this as a grad at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and we begin by noting the stress of war, war that is still continuing in Iraq and Afghanistan. It may have died out of the headlines, but war is still going on. It's not over. Fighting is still going on in both of those places. And the shooting this week reminds us of that. More details are emerging about the soldier who allegedly killed five of his fellow Americans in Baghdad on Monday. And we're also learning about the victims. The Associated Press is reporting the names of three of them, including Commander Charles Springle, a clinical social worker from North Carolina, Dr. Matthew Hausiel, a psychiatrist from Amarillo, Texas, and 19-year-old soldier from Federalsburg, Maryland, named Michael Edward Yates, Jr. The alleged shooter, Sergeant John Russell, had recently been relieved of his weapon by commanding officers, but on Monday, though, it didn't matter. Russell reportedly wrestled the weapon away from an officer who was escorting him away from a mental health clinic. He went into the clinic and opened fire. Russell's father, Wilburn Russell, told Texas TV station WFAA on Tuesday that his son was hurt rather than helped by examiners in the Baghdad clinic where he allegedly opened fire.
They ruined your life. They told him, you're an idiot. You don't belong in here. We're going to break you. We're going to get you out of here. Well, that's what the stress test technicians were telling him. They just follow orders. You know, I don't know if they had a psychologist in the room with him.
Well, we're taking a look at the impact of the almost unimaginable psychological stress on servicemen and women with Major Dina Brager, who is executive officer to the Dean of West Point. She's a social psychologist who served in Iraq from 2003 to 2004. And the history of these kinds of incidents, so-called soldier-on-soldier violence in the U.S. military, Paul Springer is joining us. He's a professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. Both of our guests are at West Point. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So there was a lot of information there. I just wanted to get people caught up with the details. But basically, this goes straight to the gut, Dina. The stresses that are going on in theater in Baghdad, in Iraq, and Afghanistan right now don't diminish just because the visibility of the war diminishes, correct?
No, John. In fact, one of the things that's been really telling in the mental health research that we've done the last few years in the Army is that Most soldiers who come out of the war, maybe after one assignment or two, without post-traumatic stress disorder or some form of stress symptoms, after that third deployment, there's a relatively high number of folks who just have pretty significant mental health challenges, you know, just from coming off a third deployment. So really, as the war's gone on, the mental health challenges have significantly increased.
You know, some of the details, Major, of this particular incident motivate some questions about the actual clinical environment there in Baghdad. I mean, this occurred at a clinic.
Yeah.
If you listen to the father, apparently this was a retaliation against the clinicians.
Yeah.
We don't know if that's true or not. What kind of pressure are the clinicians under in a situation like this?
I mean, unfortunately, I was in this situation as a commander even back in 2003 where folks, you know, were under enough stress and not doing well enough that you needed to bring them to a clinic to seek help. So, gosh, it brings me right back there.
I can hear it.
To a few years ago. And, I just think this is such a tough situation. Like, if you're a commander and you're responsible for, you know, the good order and discipline of your unit, and you're responsible for caring for, you know, a number of soldiers, maybe, you know, 150 or 200, you have to make decisions based on, you know, what's good for the unit and the individual. And then, you know, you bring a soldier down to a mental health clinic where they're not necessarily bonded with the clinicians and they don't necessarily have a repetitive, trusting relationship with them. But you, as a commander, really need a professional to make a decision on mental health fitness that you're not necessarily qualified to make. So you, as a commander, are relying on the mental health officials. The mental health officials are really trying to do their jobs and support both the soldier and the Army, because really they're charged with, you know, taking care of the individual and making sure that they're fit to be under stressful conditions. So,
right. Well, I mean, it's also a decision that could end the career of any soldier, and a lot of people in Iraq are career military. Paul Springer, let's talk a little bit about the historical context of incidents of these types. I mean, the number of deployments is, in some sense, historically unprecedented, at least in the modern era of warfare in the United States. But go back a little farther. Where does this fit?
Well, quite frankly, it's not as unprecedented as you might suggest. If you look at the type of combat deployments, say from World War II, you had individuals that were in continual combat for more than a year in the European theater, for a lot more than that, really, in the Pacific theater of island after island after island being assaulted. In Vietnam, you had repeated deployments for some individuals, for people that had chosen the Army for their career. So you had a lot of officers that had repeated deployments and a lot of non-commissioned officers that had repeated deployments. It's really only the conscripted enlisted personnel who were doing 1 year of service in Vietnam and then being released from service.
Paul, this is Farai. There is the term fragging, and in Vietnam, there were many incidents of people killing their commanders, for example.
Sure.
One case that I've heard about personally involved troops that were going to be sent on a suicide mission, and instead they just killed their commander in Vietnam. There have been some allegations that has occurred in Iraq, but I have not heard anything substantiated. But what is the... You know, the military runs on an incredible reliance of discipline and chain of command. How does that break down, when you look at historical examples? When does that break down?
Sure. In the case of Vietnam, there really is a massive breakdown that occurs. Really, 1969 is kind of the breaking point for Vietnam when it comes to a massive rise in fragging incidents, a massive rise in soldier-on-soldier violence. And what it really boils down to is a disconnect between the stated mission of the military forces and the actual performance of that mission. So in the case of Vietnam, after the Tet Offensive, when American soldiers had been told that the war was going well, that everything was being successful, that we were making progress, and then they're suddenly surprised by a massive attack by hundreds of thousands of enemy troops that's coordinated against every major southern Vietnamese city, they begin to realize that, in fact, maybe the military leadership is either unaware of what's going on or is being deceptive about the current situation.
Wow.
And when they start to feel that disconnect, when they feel like their leadership isn't looking out for their best interests, that's when you start to see a breakdown in morale.
Well,
the breakdown in morale leads to a breakdown in discipline.
Well, let's explore that disconnect from our own perspective here, Dina Brager. Is there a disconnect in that the Iraq war is kind of out of the headlines and there's a sense that it's winding down because that's the policy of the Obama administration? And does that have the effect of increasing stress or a sense of isolation?
Sure, I don't really think people in the military feel that way. I really do think that the stress is just so much, and still in the military, unfortunately, there's a stigma about getting mental health care. And obviously, if you're deployed and you're busy every day and going on missions and kind of doing your job in Baghdad, there's not a whole lot of time for you to sit down and reflect and kind of take time out and go get mental health care and work through some of that when you're actually in theater. So I really do think that the stress continues. I think American soldiers feel like people know they're over in Iraq and Afghanistan and that they're working hard. I just think they're under such conditions that, you know, there's really not been a break for a number of years. And as these multiple deployments continue, and of course, I don't know if Sergeant Russell's on a first deployment, second or third, but I guess I really don't think that matters as much as there are just some significant stressors that people are under. And, you know, it's hard to take care of that all in theater.
Well, Dina, I mean, forgive me, but I really kind of have to ask this. I mean, how do you tell a soldier who you know is under this stress in theater at a clinic like this one that Russell was at to hold on, help is on the way, when maybe in your gut you don't know if that's even true?
Well, I mean, I think as a commander, that may be of why his commander even sent him to the clinic. I mean, you know, what does happen is if the doctors determine that it would be in your best interest to go back to the States or not be there, they'll make that decision, and that's what will happen. So a lot of times if you're a commander and you feel like a soldier's really suffering and not doing well to the point of maybe needing to go home, this would be the procedure that you'd follow.
Paul, before we go, what do you think Americans need to know about this to set it in context, to either not be too alarmist or to cast a sort of a broad verdict on soldiers in the Iraq War?
Quite frankly, from a historical standpoint, it's still extremely, extremely, extremely rare. Soldier-on-soldier violence, thankfully, is something that does not happen on a regular basis. It's not an epidemic of violence. It is the exception to the rule. And that was true in Vietnam as well.
Right.
The vast majority of soldiers in Vietnam did not engage in any of this type of behavior.
An exception, but nevertheless upsetting. I thank both of you for helping us to set it in context. Paul Springer is a professor of history at the American Academy at West Point, and Major Dina Bragger is an executive officer to the dean of the Academy at West Point. Both were at West Point speaking to us. Thanks again to both of you.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here.
Hey, John. It's Farai Chidea. Today, the Senate Judiciary Committee is tackling the specter of torture. Did we or didn't we as a nation? Well, we've got Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent, with us to discuss that matter. It's a complicated topic. We have a lot to talk about. Let's start out with information that's likely to come out of the hearings, Todd. What should we expect?
All right. Well, this is the Senate Judiciary Committee, and the star witness of this hearing is going to be a guy named Ali Soufan. He's a former FBI interrogator, al-Qaeda expert in 2002, who actually interrogated Abu Zubaydah, a high-value al-Qaeda target, at an undisclosed location. People think it was in Thailand at one of the CIA black sites, but that has not been declassified. Soufan claims that he interrogated Abu Zubaydah and got information on well-known terrorists like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Jose Padilla without using so-called enhanced interrogation or torture. He has since come out recently, op-ed in the New York Times, saying these controversial techniques, regardless of what you call them, waterboarding certainly, were not necessary. I got great information out of these guys without using these techniques. Soufan was the man who, when the orders came down from the Justice Department, from Gonzalez, from Cheney, from the White House, ostensibly, to say, you can use waterboarding, you can use these techniques, that he reacted in a negative way, said, we're Americans, we can't do this, this runs counter to what we're here for, and he ran up against CIA operatives and CIA contractors, wound up in a conflict with them and was sent home because he wasn't on board with enhanced interrogation or torture, and was sent home and has been silent for many, many years because, of course, all of this is classified. He has now come out. He's the star witness today. It's going to be the first time he's testified in public.
Well, we're going to talk more about Mr. Soufan in a second, but let's just quickly touch on the party politics here. The Democrats organized the hearing. Republicans are trying to turn the tables. They're raising the question of what Democrats knew when they knew it. And we want to talk a little bit about Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, who's been very vocal. Here he is speaking yesterday on Capitol Hill.
The policymaker is the one you'd have to focus on. And if it were a crime to talk about these interrogation techniques, and you read a member of Congress into what you were planning, are they part of the criminal enterprise?
Now, it sounds like he's saying that Nancy Pelosi and whoever else was in the briefings, that they could be criminals themselves. That's a huge charge. And I actually want to take a listen to Democratic California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
You know, realize this. Most of us didn't know what waterboarding was when we began this. And I would hazard a guess that most of you didn't know that what waterboarding was. And, you know, clearly we now know. Clearly we have now had an opportunity to go much more deeply into these things.
So we're all
right,
guilty?
Well, John Fry, these two lawmakers are very interesting. Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi, both well-known lawmakers, both from California. Feinstein is currently chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. Back in 2002, Nancy Pelosi was ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee. The Republicans have tried to draw Pelosi into this. What did she know and when did she know it? And if these techniques are so terrible, why didn't she say something at the time? Now, some of this is still classified. Pelosi claims that she was told that waterboarding had been legally authorized but had never been told that it was used. And Republicans say that that's not true. Dianne Feinstein is, like we said, chairman of the Intelligence Committee. She has her own hearing going on. She's not happy about any of these proceedings today, really. But Lindsey Graham there saying that you have to look at policymakers, he's not saying that lawmakers should be prosecuted. He's saying that if you're going to go down this road of deciding who was criminal in coming up with legal justifications for government policies, then you have to look at everybody, not only who came up with the policies, but who knew about them. So they're trying to turn the tables a little bit.
Is this something where, you know, essentially it's going to become more of a referendum on what Congress has done as opposed to a referendum on whether or not the U.S. tortured?
Well, it may not be a referendum on what Congress has done because these decisions were made in the administration and in the Justice Department. Now, it may be a referendum on what Congress does in the future and what kind of laws they manage to pass. The chairman of the Judiciary Committee, Patrick Leahy, has said he wants a truth commission, a bipartisan truth commission, to get all of these things out, not only what was ordered and whether it was legal and whether the advice was potentially criminal, but who knew what went in Congress. He says let it all come out. Well, no one's interested in a review like that. Certainly not the Republicans, certainly not the White House. The president's not interested in it either. He's more supportive of a review that Feinstein has going on in the Intelligence Committee, which is classified, where they feel like they're going to get to more information. Listen to Dianne Feinstein here, the chairman of the Intelligence Committee. She's talking about just this very issue.
I mean, I'll be candid. I wish we had an opportunity to do our work first and to nail down certain things and then talk to Mr. Sofahn.
So, again, you mentioned that Ali Sofahn is a former FBI agent testifying. Do we know he's speaking broadly about CIA officials and Vice President Cheney and enhanced interrogation techniques? What do we expect out of his testimony?
Well, if you read some articles that have been written about him in the last week, if you read his op-ed in the New York Times from about a week and a half ago, he was there. And he says, we got very valuable information from Abu Zubaydah. And when I was there, it was before the August 1st, 2002 memo, the so-called torture memos, that justified all this. We got great information without using these techniques. We didn't need them. Now, the vice president disagrees. The CIA says they have counterclaims saying we got very valuable information using these techniques. You've heard Republican intelligence ranking members of the Intelligence Committee saying release everything, declassify it, and prove that we got valuable information using these techniques.
It's fascinating stuff. That's Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. Thanks, Todd. And now we are being graced with the presence of Femi Okeh with the headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. The European Union is fining chip manufacturer Intel a record $1.4 billion for anti-competitive behavior. The European Union says that the chip maker gave discounts to companies to buy all of their chips from Intel and to delay the launch of computers based on chips made by rival manufacturer AMD. NASA says damage caused to the shuttle Atlantis during its launch is not serious. The thermal tiles were probably scratched by debris during the liftoff, and the space shuttle Atlantis is expected to latch on to the Hubble Space Telescope today to begin a week's worth of repairs. And in Sri Lanka, the Red Cross says that one of its local workers was killed in the combat zone in the north of the island, and the Sri Lankan army claims that it thwarted an attempt to suicide boat attack today from the Tamil Tiger rebels. The only hospital in Sri Lanka's war zone was shelled again today for the second time in 2 days, and a government doctor at the facility says that at least 15 people died, and the reports can't be confirmed by independent sources, but Human Rights Watch says that the satellite images of the war zone indicate that the government shelling the area despite its repeated denials. That's a look at stories, international and domestic, making news this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, pomp in these circumstances. College grads, so think way into the future and tell your grandchildren what advice you would give them if they were just starting out in these economic times. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And we know it's a little speculative. I mean, you're trying to make the decision now. But imagine what you would tell your grandchildren about how you made it through these times. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. So grads, got your cap and gown?
What are you going to do now? I meant with your future.
Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
I just want to say one word to you. Plastics.
I don't want to sell anything, buy anything, or process anything as a career. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed, or buy anything sold or processed, or process anything sold bought.
But the question remains, what are we going to do now? Fellow graduates, the answer is simple. I don't know.
1.6 million people are expected to get an undergraduate degree this year, and that doesn't even count the advanced degrees. Let's match this with the fairly frightening economic numbers. In today's workforce, there are approximately 5 people out of work for every available job. Lindsay Pollack joins us now. She's an author, speaker, and career consultant. Her book is Getting From College to Career, 90 Things to Do Before You Join the Real World. She's in our studio here in the real world. Lindsay, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So for the generation that's coming of age, that's walking down the aisle with the cap and gown and excited about graduation, but maybe not so excited about looking around, how is this an opportunity and not the worst luck in the world?
You know, I understand the students who feel like it's the worst luck in the world because we've lived through such boom times in their life. The way I see it as an opportunity is there was sort of this funnel system for so many years that certain companies would recruit on campuses. It was easy to get those jobs. You would slide into those positions. And 5 or so years later, you'd say, wait a minute, why am I doing this? I didn't choose it. So I think the opportunity is for all those students who want to make a conscious choice about what they want to do. There's nothing to lose right now, so you might as well try to find your passion.
So the skill that you learn in these economic times, in these pomp circumstances, is that you get to choose your future as opposed to just sort of coast into something and then wake up in middle age, maybe a tortured soul.
I think that's a piece of it. I think the other really important piece is to learn resilience and to learn that things aren't always good. These students really have lived through times where it seemed that you would always just move up and make a lot more money. And I think the skill they're going to learn is resilience and persistence and survival through difficult times, which is something they haven't had to learn quite yet.
So the reason I'm such a great person is I graduated in the 1970s during the last
Absolutely.
Really horrible recession.
Look where you are now.
Thank you very much.
You know, what came to mind for me was the folks who lived through the Great Depression, and we're going to be talking later in the show about some projects about food in the Depression era. But, you know, there were some incredible articles recently with people who lived through the Great Depression and just had to learn how to cope on a fundamental basis. Some people have talked about young Americans having too many advantages and becoming over-reliant on expectations of success. But I want to also ask you about generations. How are we even defining the generations of people? What groups do you see, demographically as some people talk about millennials, Gen Y. What are we really talking about in terms of ages?
The age of the graduates this year, Generation Y and millennial in my mind are the same group. You're generally born 1980, 1982 or later. And what's interesting about this generation is they had been told their whole lives that they were going to move up in the workforce, move up in the world, and the boomers were on their way out. And what's happening is now the boomers aren't going anywhere in the workforce. They're sticking around in those jobs. So you've got Gen Ys born 80s and 90s, Gen Xers born 60s and 70s, boomers, even some traditionals still in the workforce, and it's getting very crowded.
And this orderly procession of everybody moves up, boomers out of the way, has suddenly completely broken down. Well, how does that manifest itself on the very different populations in college right now? You've got people who are in college, maybe Ivy League, but not exclusively, who are looking for a credential. Maybe it's a little bit of an abstract credential, a badge to take into some sort of sense of privilege. But you've also got people who are looking for a specific set of skills, be they physicists or be they engineers, and maybe they're at the community college level, but they could also be in the Ivy League. How does your advice change depending on the reasons people are in college?
You know, it's a great point. You've got first-generation Americans. You've got a lot of students who are the first in their families to go to college who are paying for every dollar of it themselves. And then you have up the chain to the more privileged students who can go back and live at home and maybe coast for a year through the recession. So you've got to think about the reasons.
Which are
people...
you?
No comment.
Let me see.
A combination of both, I would say.
Well, if you're paying your own dollar for college, I mean, you've got to make it count because you're not going to get another shot.
Well, interestingly, what I'm seeing at college campuses and technical schools is that those students have been working throughout college. So they have a lot more experience, a lot more connection, so to speak, in the real world. And most of those kids have jobs lined up because they have no choice. And I think when I give advice to the more privileged students or those who maybe don't, quote, have to work, I always tell them, look at your peers, look at your classmates. They have found jobs. They're out there. You just might need to start at a level that you weren't expecting.
And work experience is a great tool to get you into the workforce regardless. So students who worked through school are often better prepared regardless of what trades they were actually in.
Sure, realistic. You know, whether they were waitressing or working at a bookstore or pumping gas or anything, you have real experience. You understand the day-to-day. You have the stamina to start at the bottom and move your way up. And I think to students who can't find jobs, there is no shame in starting in an entry-level position. Wherever you are, you can make the most of it. And that's what those other students really have proven to me.
Last question before we go, and I did a lot of this when I was in college. What's the dumbest thing you can do, the real kind of like bad decision you can make right now if you're a graduate?
In my opinion, the only bad decision you can make is being paralyzed and doing nothing. As long as you take some kind of job, move forward in some way, you can make the most of it. The worst thing you can do is sit in your dorm room playing video games and just hope that a job will come to you.
Well said. Lindsay Pollack, author, speaker, and career consultant specializing in Gen Y career and workplace issues. Her book is Getting from College to Career, 90 Things to Do Before You Join the Real World. And here with a report on the real world is Femi Oke with the headlines.
Thanks, John. 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Retail sales have fallen by 0.4% in April. Just got that news in now. That's the second straight month in which they've fallen, and that is worse than analysts have been expecting. Days after announcing its first losses in nearly six decades, the Japanese car giant Toyota has drastically cut its production targets. The company says it will make just 6.7 million vehicles next year, 28% fewer than in the last 12 months. It expects the current tax year to be its worst on record. And car dealers from around the nation are heading to Washington today to ask President Obama's auto task force to let the economy decide which car dealers should be shut down, not the task force. The task force has been pushing GM to close more dealers than originally planned as part of its restructuring efforts. U.S. foreclosure filings jumped to a record high in April. Rick Schager is the senior vice president of RealtyTrack, and it compiles the foreclosure data.
What we think we're seeing right now is a sort of delayed response. We've seen delinquency rates increase at a much faster pace than foreclosure activity over the prior two quarters. And it looks like the dam has burst and we're being flooded with new foreclosures.
And we have 32% more foreclosures now than we did a year ago. Let's look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway, and I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and he's a pitching legend, but he may be a legend behind bars for saying things like this.
That's exactly right. He's never injected me with HGH or steroids.
That's Roger Clemens yesterday on ESPN's Mike and Mike show, where the legendary pitcher once again denied that his trainer, Brian McNamee, ever injected him with steroids. He's responding to charges in a new book, American Icon: The Fall of Roger Clemens and the Rise of Steroids in America's Pastime, which reports extensively on Clemens' use of the drugs and claims that he lied under oath to Congress about it.
What I've read and seen, the portions of it are completely false. And, you know, guys, it's piling on. And, you know, it's hurtful at times, but, you know, I'm moving on.
Moving on. Right. So your book is a pile of lies. Nathaniel Vinton, who's part of the New York Daily News' investigative sports team and author of American Icon, welcome to the studio. You're a liar, according to Roger Clemens.
Well, thanks for having me here, but I disagree with Roger.
Why is it that he persists in making this such a conflict, a public conflict? There's no question that he's going to be remembered more for this ultimately than almost anything else.
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I think it's partly his personality. Something our book, a big theme of our book is just that he's always been this guy who when he's against the ropes, he tries to intimidate. He tries to throw brushback pitches, and that's basically what he tried to do in the legal arena. So it's the personality.
Well, the bases are loaded with prosecutors here. Explain how he might actually end up behind bars because of the kinds of things he said.
Well, you know, you can differentiate him from any of the other rogues in baseball's steroid era by just the fact that they're going to make an example of him. He went to Congress. He had a five-hour deposition, a five-hour hearing. He was under oath. He knew what the stakes were, and he he said he never used steroids and human growth hormone against a massive amount of circumstantial evidence.
Now, in theory, this is the exact same case against Barry Bonds. Why would it be so different with Bonds, or seemingly different with Bonds, than it seems to be moving towards with Clemens?
You know, they're actually pretty different. Bonds was in front of a grand jury.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't the target of the investigation. They were going for Victor Conti, the founder of Balco, and his co-conspirators. And the questions that were asked of Bonds were really kind of wishy-washy. They said, you haven't used steroids or anything like that. So they gave Bonds' lawyers, who are good lawyers, a lot of wiggle room to get him off, and then a lot of evidence has been thrown out. This was Congress. He raised his hand. He knew exactly what he was getting into. It was televised, and those congressmen are mad.
So the question really is the precision with which Clemens has denied, and therefore the allegation would be has lied, means that the crosshairs are really right on his reputation at this point.
Yeah, during that hearing, some of the Republicans who attacked his accuser and seemed to be defending him in the hallways in Congress, some of those same people are now calling for him to go behind bars. So,
isn't there something sad about this? I mean, Clemens was an incredible pitcher for the Red Sox, an incredible pitcher for the Yankees.
Yeah, it's incredibly sad. I was a big fan of Roger Clemens.
Was.
Well, my little kid, my very first memories of baseball were Roger Clemens' memories.
Hmm. Well, the memories of Roger Clemens are likely to be framed by this new book, American Icon, The Fall of Roger Clemens and the Rise of Steroids in America's Pastime. The author, Nathaniel Vinton, who's part of the Daily News investigative sports team, joined us here in the studio. Thanks, Nate.
Thanks.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Farai Jadea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. We're calling out to graduates today. Send us a snapshot of your landscape as you look out over the future.
I just graduated from an advanced law degree program. The recession has caused a lot of the firms around me to actually lay off my friends. Now the pool is being diluted with all of these overly qualified and more experienced attorneys, which is making it really tough to find a job.
That hurts. Chris from Massachusetts, we want to hear from you as well. If you're graduating this year, how are you coping? For those of you who have long since finished school, what's your advice for today's grads? Call us with your stories at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Femi Oke has some headlines now.
Thank you very much. The time is 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The European Union is fining American chip manufacturer Intel a record $1.4 billion for anti-competitive behavior. The EU says the company gave discounts to computer manufacturers to buy all of their chips from Intel and to delay the launch of computers based on chips made by Advanced Micro Devices, which is Intel's main rival. In Bethlehem today, Pope Benedict underlined his support for the establishment of a Palestinian state. He then held a mass in the town's manger square, believed to be the birthplace of Jesus Christ. And the Pope is also planning a visit to a refugee camp. The World Health Organization is telling countries to save their swine flu drugs for high-risk patients. Officials want to keep enough supplies handy in case the virus mutates and becomes more dangerous. And finally, last night, the White House was buzzing with the sounds of poetry, music and prose. Amongst the performers, James Earl Jones, Esperanza Spalding and 19-year-old University of Pennsylvania student Joshua Brandon Bennett. Joshua gave us a little taste of the poem he performed at the White House earlier today.
I know that there is no poem that can make up for all the time we have lost, so please, if you can, just listen as I play you a symphony on the strings of my heart, made for no other ears on this earth but yours.
That's Joshua Brandon Bennett, one of the poets who performed last night at the White House. And the First Lady said that she wanted to open up the White House to a whole range of different and diverse voices. And that is a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi.
Everybody's working in this town, and it's worried me night and day.
Yes, everybody's got the blues, or at least they did during the Great Depression. That blues song in particular was about the WPA, the project that President Franklin Roosevelt decided could help unemployed folks, including writers. As part of the New Deal, the Federal Writers Project, part of the WPA, sent people like novelist Zora Neale Hurston across the nation to document people's lives, people's struggles, including the topic of regional food. In fact, there was a project called America Eats, and there's actually a book out now, The Food of a Younger Land, which compiled this unfinished, lost WPA project. We have the author with us now, Mark Kolansky. Mark, how you doing?
Pretty good. How are you?
So the saying goes, you are what you eat. And if that's true, in this book, we are possum, or at least we were possum. We were squirrel. We were corn. How different is the food in this book from what we continue to eat today?
Well, the food in the book is was the reality of the time, very similar to what's a popular movement now of, you know, trying to be regional and seasonal. But at the time, it was what was there, what was available. There wasn't a national highway system. There wasn't a lot of air transport, and people and food weren't being flown. They weren't being moved around the country that much, and people pretty much lived off of what their area produced, and there were very strong local traditions, and you could travel around America on what they called highways, which were two-lane, and stop at restaurants along the way, and from not just region to region, but county to county, you would experience different food.
What do you think these writers, I mean, you have people like Eudora Welty, Zora Neale Hurston, all sorts of known and unknown writers, pieces that are signed and unsigned. What do you think it was like for them to be out on the road? What do you know about these manuscripts that were never published until now?
Well, the Federal Writers Project, which was organized in state by state and had over 4,000 writers. Some of them really were writers. Some of Zora Neale Hurston had published three books, including a very highly regarded novel, and some of them had never published so much as an article. The primary requirement was that you had to have no job and no money.
Which a lot of people had at that point.
A lot of writers qualify for that.
Yes, exactly. Right, yeah. Still today.
But a lot of writers, but also, secretaries and, like today, there were a lot of newspapers folding, and all of those people from newspapers got jobs at the Federal Writers Project. And so these manuscripts had a wide range of quality. Some of them are, beautifully written. Some of them were so terrible, wouldn't have even contemplated publishing them.
But what was it like to handle this archive? I mean, it must have smelled like it must have evoked a whole other era.
Yeah, it did. It was like opening a time capsule. I mean, first of all, remember onion skin? They were all carbon copies on onion skin. And you open these boxes and you realize you were in a different time. And, you know, some of them probably had never been read before. You know, they weren't even read by the editors. There was this panic after the attack on Pearl Harbor, because in this archive they also have a lot of the correspondence, and you could see after December 7th, 1942, all of these letters went out saying, "Please get your copy in right now," because they understood that, you know, World War II was about to start and that would be the end of the WPA, and in fact it was. Before they ever really even got to the editing stage of this project.
Well, you know, one of the things that strikes me when you talk about language is that, you know, you do have everything from articles that are pretty much straight ahead recipes. You know, this is what people eat. This is how they cook it. To ones that have a little bit more of a narrative. One of them is the North Carolina Chitterling Strut, which is written in dialect about black folks eating chitlins. What do you think of the way language was approached in that piece, you know, and how people observed each other and wrote about each other?
Well, you know, I said it was like opening a time capsule, and, you know, the good and bad things about visiting 1940 America. And one of the things you realize, especially when you read the southern parts, is, you know, you're now in the pre-civil rights South. And, you know, this is the WPA. These were the great liberals and progressives of the time. And, you know, some of the language is so racist, and some of the, you know, the dialogues with black people who are identified only by first name and comma a Negro, and you know, a lot of it read like masters and slaves, and
that's really interesting.
Well, you know, it's an important narrative to hold on to, but there's also some, I mean, this is just straight up comedy to me. New York soda luncheonette slang and jargon, axle grease, butter, a yard of, dish of spaghetti, baby, glass of milk, Bay State bum, customer who demands much service and leaves no tip. I think every waitress has gotten one. It's just like, and then it goes on for pages of this great slang. Yeah.
Did you try any of the recipes in here? Anything encourage you to cook up a squirrel?
Well, you know, these were Appalachian flying squirrels, which are pretty rare these days. The one recipe I did try was from southern Indiana. I have an attachment to Indiana because I went to college there, and for persimmon pudding, which is still very well known in only about two or three counties of Indiana.
Oh, that's interesting. I've had a lot of persimmons, but never persimmon pudding. Well, fascinating topic, Mark Kurlansky, and I'm hoping we can put a couple recipes of this up on our website at thetakeaway.org. The Food of a Younger Land is your book, and, you know, I will try to be not to be a Bay State bum. Thanks, Mark.
It's in our ongoing series, Pomp in These Circumstances. We've been looking at the obstacles facing graduates this year. We want to know how you're coping. Or years from now, what do you think you'll tell your grandchildren about graduating in these times? One listener writes to us to say, "I wouldn't tell my grandchildren anything. My advice is don't get into debt, don't buy things, don't have children, don't put yourself at the mercy of the system." Here's a bit of advice.
The only bad decision you can make is being paralyzed and doing nothing. As long as you take some kind of job, move forward in some way, you can make the most of it. The worst thing you can do is sit in your dorm room playing video games and just hope that a job will come to you.
Your takeaway this hour comes from Lindsay Pollack, author, speaker, and career consultant. If you missed anything, we're always on here on The Takeaway. Take our podcast to go.
Well, maybe I'll become a video game designer, huh? I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.
Verdict on justice. We're all guilty.
I feel bad, so bad. Though I ain't done nothing wrong, I feel bad.
A prosecutor finds himself behind bars and in front of students, lawyering while black. Paul Butler's critique of the justice system, getting away is different than getting free. If I could get away with murder, I'd take my gun and I'd commit it. Judicial errors of commission on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. A critique of the justice system on this Wednesday, May 13th. I'm John Huckenberry, joined today by Farai Chidea once again. Good morning, Farai.
Hey, John. So coming up further, we take a look at the role race plays in the justice system, always controversial. We're also going to look ahead to the president's meeting with top Senate leaders about the Supreme Court nominee and get the latest on the violent standoff in Sri Lanka. That's all coming up, but first these headlines.
And in the headlines, cease the illegal practices immediately. That's the directive from the European Union to American chip manufacturer Intel. The EU's Neelie Kroes says the company is monopolizing the market by offering rebates to computer manufacturers to use Intel chips.
For this abusive behavior, the Commission has fined Intel for 1,060 million euros,
which is equivalent to $1.4 billion. It's a record. Intel says the fine is wrong and will appeal. Japanese car giant Toyota is drastically cutting its production targets. The company says it will make just 6.7 million vehicles next year, a 28% drop from this year's production. It comes days after announcing its first loss in nearly six decades. Farai?
Well, speaking of cars, American dealers from around the nation are heading to Washington to urge President Obama's auto task force to ask the president to stay out of deciding how fast car dealers should be shut down. Now, the task force has been pushing GM to close dealerships faster than originally planned as part of this overall restructuring. In Afghanistan, a lawmaker says 95 children were among the 140 people killed in a very controversial U.S.-Taliban battle in Farah province earlier this month. A U.S. spokesman says insurgents are responsible for the deaths because they forced villagers to remain in their homes during the fighting. The U.S. won't say how many people it thinks were killed in the battle. And the Senate holds a public hearing today on the so-called torture memos. It's the first since their release. An aide to former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is going to testify about internal debates within the Bush administration on the interrogation techniques.
And the big question is Nancy Pelosi's briefing going to come up in those hearings? Very, very interesting stuff. Todd Zwillick was talking about that this morning. Today marks the last of five phases of voting in India's general election. 107 million people are eligible to cast their ballots just today. Results on Saturday. The Dow and S&P were mostly flat yesterday. The Dow kicks off at 84.69. The S&P starts trading at 9.08. Bad economic number out just this past hour. Retail sales fell 0.4% in April. So they had a poetry jam at the White House last night. Did you notice?
Oh, yeah.
Very hot ticket, very much fun, opening the White House to different kinds of voices. We want you to continue that poetry jam right here on The Takeaway. Pick a poem, jam it for us, call 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Hey, danger. You're going to jail tonight for disorderly conduct, you understand?
For what, man?
For what?
You know I'm not going to do nothing, you know what I'm saying?
Okay, you grab.
You
watch
know
you,
me.
I watched you grab the bottle, and you turned
you.
Around
I swear
toward
to God,
him.
That's all suggressive, okay. But I didn't see you.
Okay. We don't stamp for that up here, man. You don't. You know you don't do that.
Who else is going to protect
me? Come on, danger. You know you were.
Call the police.
Hey, I'm Farai Chidea. That's from the reality TV show Cops. And this guy, Danger, clearly doesn't believe the police are going to protect him.
No.
Millions of Americans feel the same way. Not just that the police won't protect him, but that the criminal justice system just operates on money, power, racism, all those things. Race, of course, does affect the system. So does money. System's flawed. So, would you sabotage it? Would you actually go ahead and basically say, okay, these rules don't work. They shouldn't apply. Paul Butler has some controversial ideas on that subject. He's a law professor at George Washington University and a former federal prosecutor. Paul, it's great to talk to you again. And you've got this new book called Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. I'm going to get to the hip-hop part of that in a second, but you start out in this book telling us a story about how your path changed as a prosecutor who got caught up in the legal system for something you were acquitted of. But it's a great story. Tell us, first of all, about Detroit.
Detroit, for I was my neighbor. I'd taken a job with the Department of Justice, wanted to kind of be the avenger, do the right thing. So I left my fancy, well-paying law firm job and moved to a neighborhood that I could afford on my government salary. And Detroit was a woman who lived across the parking lot from me, who was renting a parking space that became the subject of this big dispute.
So she's someone who, and you're very, literary about the way that you describe her, this big-boned, not very attractive woman who ultimately ended up in a conflict, in a dispute with you over a parking spot, ended up sabotaging someone else's car, but then saying that you were the one who attacked her. So what was it?
She called the police and said that I'd pushed her and that she'd fallen down. And it was just a silly story, but for whatever reason, I don't know, you now go back and wonder, did part of it have to do with the fact that I'm an African-American man? At that time, I was a young African-American man. So the police came, and they kind of summarily arrested me. They arrested me for a crime that I didn't commit. It was a misdemeanor. And the only difference, that's a familiar story in the African-American community, and the only difference for was that I happened to be a prosecutor at the time that I was arrested.
Big difference.
You talk about how you could afford a great lawyer, how your colleagues didn't turn their backs on you. But still, did you feel powerless, when you were arrested on what turned out to be a false charge?
Well, I'll tell you, the name of the case was the United States of America versus Paul Butler. And in that situation, you got to feel a little bit powerless. So, I knew that I was in a better situation than virtually anybody could be who was charged with a crime like this, because I could afford the best lawyer in town. I had connections. I had legal skills. I knew how to present myself to a jury. And, by the way, I was innocent. And that last fact, it didn't really seem like the most important. And that really opened my eyes to a lot of the concerns that I was developing about the criminal justice system anyway from my day-to-day work of locking up people, putting people in prison. Even then, I'd started to question how much good I was really doing for communities. But when I got caught up, it opened my eyes in a whole different way.
Paul, you sound like such a nice, reasonable man. And then you go ahead and talk about things like jury nullification and basically throwing a spanner, into the justice system. Not just, kind of incremental change, but you know what? We're just going to roll with this right now. Give me an example of what you think people have a right to do. I mean,
what the Constitution says, Farai, is that if there's a crime that someone's charged with, and for some reason the jurors think that the prosecution is unfair or the person shouldn't be punished because the law is unfair, then the juror doesn't have to convict, even if technically the person's guilty. So that's called jury nullification. It's a proud part of our constitutional history. I think the best cases are back in the day when slavery was legal, and it was actually a crime to help a slave escape. So people would be put on trial for that crime. And in the North, jurors would always acquit. Even though the person was technically guilty of the crime, they just didn't think that the law was fair. And so the Supreme Court had many occasions to review it, always said it's a power that jurors have, although this is where it gets bizarre. the law is that jurors don't have to be told about this power. And so that's what I'm doing in Let's Get Free for Ryan John. I'm telling jurors about this secret power they have. If they think the law is unfair, they don't have to apply it just because some prosecutor says they should.
Instructions to the jury from Paul Butler in his book Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. And what's so fascinating about this narrative, Paul, to me, one of many things, is that this is really a conflict of profiles that you fit. You fit the profile of the incredibly successful, fast-track, African-American legal sort of litigator and scholar on the way up, right?
Yes.
And you also fit this urban African-American profile of a male. You even describe it yourself as someone with a chip on his shoulder. And you explore that profile by talking about how pop culture figures within the African-American community who some would say, and you have argued persuasively, have been targets of the criminal justice system, ending up in prison as a result. And they have absorbed that experience and, you know, projected a certain coolness for having gone to prison. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, you know.
Well, the question to you is, do you feel cool for having been locked up even for the short amount of time, even though you were acquitted?
I feel like the experience made a man out of me, John. It made a black man out of me. And it connected me to a lot of people who, I have to say, going to schools like Yale and Harvard Law School, working at big fancy law firms, I hadn't felt all that close to. And at the end of the day, what that experience taught me is that when the police look at me, what they see is a young African-American man. And the experience made me own up to what that meant. And frankly, I think it instilled me with a sense of responsibility.
I want to ask you about, there's so much to this, but let's talk about Stop Snitching. There's this movement, there's even a DVD with this really raw title, essentially Stop Effing Snitching. And then the Baltimore police responded with a video called Keep Talking. So, you know, how does the Stop Snitching movement relate to what you're talking about jury nullification? Do you believe that Stop Snitching is good or destructive?
Well, I think witnessing is different from snitching. So if there's a crime of violence or a property crime, then it's absolutely appropriate for citizens to call the police and report. If, on the other hand, you get something like a break in your own criminal case or money for reporting somebody else, then I think we have to be thoughtful about whether that advances public safety and about whether that makes communities whole. And what was happening in Baltimore, which has an extraordinary rate of incarceration, almost half of the young black men have a criminal case, usually a drug case. What that means, Farai, is that in those communities, everybody has some incentive to rat out everybody else. And it turns out that undermines the social fabric. You know, it's like one of those old Eastern European societies where everybody's got something against someone else, so everyone's looking for a deal or a way to curry favor with the government.
You know,
that
Paul,
turns out to make communities less safe.
I'm not trying to pat you on the back, and you know, we're rust on the clock on this show all the time. But you know, should someone like you be on the Supreme Court? Someone with these kinds of views of change, of pushing the sort of political dimension of the jury system, be on the Supreme Court? There's a vacancy, you know.
Well, if you're recommending me, John, I'll accept the position. This is something that lawyers love to speculate about. So I suspect that the people who the president considers will have more moderate views than I. But a lot of the people whose names have been in the paper have the same concerns about the 2 million people who are locked up in our criminal justice system that I have. So they know that this warehousing, what President Obama called this counterproductive warehousing of nonviolent offenders, isn't the way to go. So I'm hoping that they'll use the Constitution to create some solutions.
Well, Paul, you have you're going to get a lot of people hot under the collar. Many thanks. We were talking with Paul Butler, law professor at George Washington University. New book is Let's Get Free, A Hip-Hop Theory of Justice. My son got knocked. Evidently, it's elementary. They want us all gone eventually. Trooping out of state for a plate. Knowledge, if coke was cooked without the garbage.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. You know, everything from Quoth the Raven, Nevermore to Eric B. and Rakim, I start to think and then I sink into the paper like I was ink. They are all rhymes. And President Obama tends to like them, even used to write them. He held a poetry jam at the White House last night. We want to have one of our own. Now, pick a poem, jam it for us, keep it short, be part of the Takeaway Poetry, 877-8-MY-TAKE. That should sort of be my mic, but 877-8-MY-TAKE or email mytake@thetakeaway.org.
John. Nevermore.
Nice rhyme. So continuing with our critique of the justice system, we're reminded that President Obama consults today with Senate leaders on his pick to replace Supreme Court Justice David Souter. Still speculation and hope about who he might choose. Female, black, Latino, what's the opportunity here? Joining us is Judge Judith Kaye, counsel with Skadden Litigation Group. Judge Kaye was the chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals for 15 years until her retirement in 2008. She served longer than any judge in New York's history and is in our studio. Good morning, Judge. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning. Pleasure to be here.
What do you think the opportunity is? We were talking with Paul Butler about the need for change in the criminal justice system. What is the chance that the president would appoint someone who would be a change agent on the court? We've heard a lot about how since Souter was liberal, he'll be replaced by a liberal, so the net effect will be nil. Is there a chance to do a change agent in this appointment, and who might such a person be?
Well, I love your word opportunity, and I seize that word. I'm a great optimist. Yes, I believe. I believe in the president. And I believe he will make an absolutely superb choice. This is an important vacancy. Of course, every vacancy on the United States Supreme Court is an important one. But I think at this juncture especially that this is an opportunity that needs to be seized. And I'm hoping that, for starters, it's going to be a woman.
Hmm. Well, we'll talk about the gender issue in a moment. The Berger Court was noted for innovating the Supreme Court system itself, changing the way the docket was organized, that sort of thing. It was a real opportunity for Warren Berger to change the way the court operated. You, similarly, were known as an innovator in the New York court system, changing the way the appeals process worked and making the judicial workload more rational. What do you think needs to be done to make the Supreme Court less of, as David Souter has noted, an intellectual lobotomy?
Well, one thing, I remember when the Chief Justice came into office, that he expressed the hope, the belief that there would be greater collegiality and unanimity coming together instead of these kind of terrible splits with a lot of harsh language that doesn't do anybody any good. And I'm sure it's disappointing to him, as it is to so many of us, to see these 5-4 splits continuing. So my hope would be that the next appointee, I know the president has used the word empathetic, and what I take that to mean is not dogmatic. And I would hope that the person who next reaches the Supreme Court will be someone who can cross the divide and help to bring the court together instead of the continued bruising splits.
What nominee, who, if she would be a woman, would surprise you, would
starters.
Excite you? Yeah, what nominee, a woman nominee, would excite you?
Well, the one I know best, and of course, you know, we don't know the list, the real list. You know, we see people suggested, but only the president and his advisors know who the real list is. The one person I know well because of her geographical proximity and long friendship is Judge Sotomayor of the Second Circuit. I say we've had we know each other for a long time as colleagues in the court system, and you know, I think she's pretty sensational.
Let me ask you about what, besides taking a look at gender, matters to you. Some people, you know, argue that President Obama wants someone who will consider the law on a case-by-case basis as opposed to someone who can pass ideological litmus tests. Is there anything that you personally think is an absolute litmus test, whether it is abortion, whether it is civil liberty, freedom of speech? Give us an example of something you think is non-negotiable.
Well, of course, extraordinary quality, high quality, beyond scholarliness, devotion to the law, dedication to the law. I love the word empathy. Considering the issues that reach the Supreme Court of the United States, someone who knows and feels and understands, yes, I agree with the president.
And you yourself have, you've done things like making a decision on adoption rights for gay couples. You've looked at the death penalty. You yourself seem like you have a lot of empathy.
Well, I hope that's true, since I've listed that as a high quality. But I say expect somebody, first and foremost, who's going to adhere to the law, not somebody who invents it every day of the week, but reads the law and approaches the law with an understanding of the human condition.
A Supreme Court justice need not even be a lawyer. It's sort of unique in that sense. It was expressed on this program last week that it might be a good idea to name somebody to the court who actually has an existential closeness to the empathy that you're talking about, as opposed to a legal basis, like someone who has political experience, maybe someone who has worked in social services. Do you see something like that as being possible?
I guess it's possible. I say I don't know who all the candidates are under consideration, and the ones I've seen generally are lawyers, and I guess we think along those lines, you know, that people have gone to law school. You know, just because you're a lawyer doesn't mean that you're narrow and haven't had the kind of worldly experience and social services experience that makes an excellent Supreme Court justice. So I guess, not knowing the list, I wouldn't be prepared to rule anyone out. My long experience just guides me back into the law-trained community, but I certainly, narrowness is something that's just off the list completely. Ideology? No, that's not what we need on the Supreme Court.
Quickly, in your own experience, is being a judge, being a prosecutor, or being a litigator, which is the most narrow of the roles?
Oh, my goodness. It's such an individual thing. Very hard to say. People so often have every kind of experience. I've been a litigator, I guess, all my life. But a prosecutor is a litigator, too. And you know, there are academics who are great Supreme Court justices. You know, I don't see any particular route, but I do see the goal, the objective. The objective can be achieved through many different routes, but the objective is what's really important.
And just remind us what the objective is.
The objective is a person of extraordinary quality, and I say I'm sorry, but I've got gender for starters, given the situation.
So it sounds like that's not negotiable. Sounds like that's not negotiable with Judge
Judith. That's a takeaway right
well,
there.
Counselor, we're gonna dismiss the witness here. Counsel with Skadden Litigation Group, previously the chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals for 15 years until her retirement in 2008, advising us on the potential nominees to replace Justice Souter. Judge Kay served longer than any judge in New York history. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you so much.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org, and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm John Hockenberry, and we begin this segment with headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. 32 minutes past the hour is the time. The Obama administration says that it will use bailout money repaid by large banks to help support smaller banks. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner says those repayments will be used to reopen the application window for banks that have less than $500 million in assets. And he also said that small banks will be able to apply for that aid for the next 6 months. And the wake-up music for the Atlantis shuttle crew this morning was Jack Johnson singing Upside Down.
I wanna turn the whole thing up. The upbeat number reflects NASA's positive assessment of the state of Atlantis's thermal shield. NASA says the damage caused to the shuttle thermal tiles during the launch is not serious. They think that the tiles were probably scratched by debris during the takeoff, and the Space Shuttle Atlantis is expected to latch onto the Hubble Space Telescope today to begin a week's worth of repairs. And John asked me a little bit earlier this morning, how do they choose the music? Mission Control choose the music because they choose the music because they like it, the idea of camaraderie, to make the crew feel like they're at one with Mission Control.
So it's not payola?
No special interest whatsoever.
Thank you, Femi.
You're very welcome.
I like the idea of space payola. I think that's a movie. Anyway, in a much more serious topic, we've been following news from the South Asian nation of Sri Lanka. Tamil Tiger rebels are fighting the government, and an estimated 50,000 Sri Lankan civilians have been trapped by that fighting. The International Red Cross says one of its local workers has been killed in a shelling attack in the conflict zone. It's not clear who carried out that attack. And in another development, the Sri Lankan military said it repulsed a wave of rebel suicide boat attacks against army positions along the coast. Yesterday, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton made her concerns known before a meeting to discuss Sri Lanka.
We're going to meet to catch up on a range of issues. In particular, we'll be issuing a statement on Sri Lanka and our continuing insistence that more be done on a humanitarian basis.
Now, thousands of Sri Lankans live in North America. They're watching and debating who's responsible for the crisis, what could help stop it. Ahilan Kadagama is in the studio with us now. He's a spokesperson for the Sri Lanka Democracy Forum, which bills itself as a global network of activists committed to promote democratization and inter-ethnic coexistence in Sri Lanka. Good morning, Ahilan.
Good morning.
What is the situation with Tamil and Sinhalese in Sri Lanka that has, you know, been the underpinnings of some of this conflict?
Since its post-colonial history in 1948, beginning with independence, both communities have been alienated by an acts of discrimination by the state. But in Sri Lanka, there are a number of minorities. There's the Tamil minority, but there's also a sizable Muslim community which has its own ethnic identity, as well as upcountry Tamils who were brought over as indentured labor. But these systematic acts of discrimination by the state on language policy, on education, on jobs in the state sector led to the emergence of a violent armed conflict about 25 years ago.
You know, if when you go to the site for your group, Sri Lanka Democracy Forum, it seems as if you have a bunch of different campaigns going on. You have a news archive. I'm intrigued by one of your working groups. It says, to prevent children from being recruited as or re-recruited as soldiers. Was that an issue at all in this conflict?
Yeah, throughout the conflict, the rebels, the Tigers, have used children as child soldiers. And even at the current moment in this small area, the size of, you know, smaller than the size of Central Park, where 50,000 people are possibly trapped, there are a number of children who are continuing to be recruited, children as young as 11 years old. So that's a big issue. Yesterday, the UN Special Representative on Children and Armed Conflict issued a statement with her concern. But for the mothers there, for the parents, this is a huge problem.
Well, Ahilan Kadagama, what do you tell, what do families in the diaspora tell their own children about what's going on? I mean, what we are seeing in this small area appears to be a kind of a cataclysmic moment of truth for everyone in this conflict.
It's true. I mean, this is probably the worst situation we've seen. And while the war is coming to an end, how it ends is going to be crucial. And there's a huge amount of suffering. People are not getting their humanitarian needs met from water, food. And then particularly the predicament of children and women is extremely dire.
Well, how do you tell your children that 11-year-olds can be recruited into war to be a part of the human shields that are a feature of this conflict?
That's part of the problem. Both the diasporas, the Sinhala diaspora and, more importantly, the much stronger Tamil diaspora, they have only been taking a very one-sided view of the conflict. They're not really thinking as deeply about the suffering of the people, which is coming under attack by both actors, the state as well as the rebels.
Speaking of the diaspora, one of the best known, probably at this point the best known Sri Lankan is the rapper MIA, who her music was in the Oscar-winning film Slumdog Millionaire. She recently asked First Lady Michelle Obama and Oprah to get involved, trying to leverage media power and political celebrity. Do you think that that would help the situation if more people in the West got involved on some level in this debate?
There needs to be much greater international attention given how serious the situation is. But even international attention, intervention has to be responsible. In the past, there have been mistakes that have been made by the international community as well. So one concern some of us have is the way in which this internationalization is happening. It shouldn't be with emotive language such as genocide or concentration camps. The message has to be about reconciliation, bring the communities together once this war is over, because the people there have suffered immensely over the last 25 years.
Well, what's the mechanism for that? I mean, typically the Indians have been mediators in this particular conflict, but they're distracted by their election. The fifth phase of it begins today. They're not involved here. Who can be a honest broker to produce a scenario that's going to be acceptable to anyone?
In terms of the human rights crisis and the humanitarian situation, the UN needs to play a much bigger role. There has been some discussion at the UN Security Council, at the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva, but that sort of engagement with the Sri Lankan government needs to continue to hold them to account. On the other hand, there needs to be a much more far-reaching political process. And ultimately, it's the people within Sri Lanka who are going to have to decide on their future, but there needs to be support and a push from the international community.
We've been speaking with Ahilan Kadagama, spokesperson for the Sri Lanka Democracy Forum.
You know, it's surprising how active the expat communities are here in the United States. When we talk about this subject, there's a lot of traffic on our website, often critical of journalists who, you know, take one position or are perceived to take one position or another.
Yeah, we actually, you know, have a whole bunch of information on, you know, from a lot of the South Asian diaspora. And you know, I think that's, there's some ethnic groups like black folks where you know a lot in the popular media, but the South Asian diaspora is varied and very deep. You know, in a city like New York, you have Pakistani, Indian, Sri Lankan, you know, that diversity, I think, is really starting to bubble up in American culture.
So there was diversity at the White House in the poetry jam that took place last night. We want to hear your poem, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Keep the jam going. Do you think in the 1850s Walt Whitman would have gone to a poetry jam at the White House?
Only a very quiet one.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Farai Chidea.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And all knickers are twisted over in the UK as a political scandal over what politicians are claiming on their expense forms seems to have completely engulfed the British Parliament and provoked endless public outrage in the tabloids and throughout the country, which could determine the fate of Prime Minister Gordon Brown. Naomi Grimley, political reporter for the BBC World Service, joins us now from London. Naomi, thanks for being with us.
Not at all.
This is as scandalous as it is entertaining. And you know, we have some of the legislators themselves who are responding to charges. But lay out exactly what has been playing out in London over the last few days.
Well, as you say, there is room for comic potential because the sheer scale of what some parliamentarians have been claiming for is quite breathtaking. We're talking about minor items like dog food. A dollar's worth of dog food was put on one expense claim, through to a couple of cents for a carrier bag, right through to the other end of the spectrum where some rural MPs in particular were basically maintaining their country estates at the expense of the taxpayers.
Well, so they Naomi, let's try to be a little empathetic here. Here's MP Douglas Hogg, who has admitted that his housekeeper was claimed on his expenses. Let's try to have a little empathy here.
I have to have two homes, as you can see, in London during the week, as is my wife. And the house is wholly unoccupied. Consequently, the cleaning and the maintenance and the looking after has to be done by somebody.
That's going to work, huh, Naomi?
Well, exactly. That didn't go down terribly well, I have to say, with the British public. It wasn't just Mr. Hogg involved, though. Some of his colleagues were claiming for repairs to swimming pools, tennis courts, even in one case, the installation of a chandelier. So we laugh about it. But on the other hand, there's been a great wave of public anger over this because people feel that it wasn't playing to the spirits of British fair play.
Well, let's talk about the political implications. It seems to favor the Conservatives. I wish you'd tell us why that is the case. And does Gordon Brown have more to worry about as of this morning, Naomi?
Well, let's be clear. This scandal actually affects all the political parties. Even minor parties have got some really bad examples of where MPs overclaimed and basically played the system. The reason why people think it will affect Gordon Brown, the Prime Minister, the most is because he's the incumbent government. And, of course, when we come to a general election, which is probably going to be next year, that means he's got the most incumbent MPs that have to go through the democratic process. And many commentators are saying that when it comes to the campaign next year, we'll probably see a lot of independent candidates trying to force out sitting MPs by waving in front of the electorate these terrible expense claims.
Is there any significance to the fact that this first came out in the Conservative newspaper, the Daily Telegraph?
Well, some people think that there is an agenda from the Telegraph. It's sometimes referred to as the Tory graph in Britain because of its political leanings. But I have to say, on Tuesday, the revelations about what Conservative opposition MPs were claiming for, their country estates, that was particularly damaging to the opposition because they've tried very, very hard over the last few years to shed their image of being the party of wealth and privilege.
Well, Naomi, we have to go, but a quick question. Your expenses there at the BBC all on the up and up, right? No problems, right?
I have to say, certainly not been installing chandeliers courtesy of the BBC.
Right. Good
but
to
I think
hear.
There will be journalists who are feeling a bit worried
good
about,
to hear.
About this.
Good to hear. Naomi Grimley, political reporter for the BBC World Service.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, soliciting opinions about schools that offer students cash rewards for improved grades and attendance records. Is it ethical? Is it bribery? Viewpoints now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. I think that I will never see a poem like a tree. Precious.
Lovely.
What was the word?
Tree.
Lovely. There we go. I was forgetting. I was having a poetry blank out moment. But you know what? You can pick a poem and jam it for us. 877-8-MY-TAKE. My take at thetakeaway.org. Femi, I hope you can remember better than me.
Oh, I think so. 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Femi, okay, do your news today on The Takeaway. Is that enough rhyme for you? I think so.
She got her own name right.
Morning. In Bethlehem today, Pope Benedict told Palestinians they have the right to a homeland.
I know how much you have suffered and continue to suffer as a result of the turmoil that has afflicted this land for decades.
The Pope also called on Palestinians not to resort to violence and terrorism in their fight for an independent state, and the Pope will visit a refugee camp later today. A new economic indicator just out this morning. Retail sales fell 0.4% in April, and that's the second straight month of decline. The World Health Organization is telling countries to save their swine flu drugs for high-risk patients. Officials want to keep enough supplies handy in case the virus mutates and becomes more dangerous. And finally, Tina Fey, watch out. Sarah Palin is ready to tell her side of her story. She announced last night that she is writing a memoir to be published next year with HarperCollins and the year that she's up for re-election. That's looking at news stories for now.
What a shocker. Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
Some campaign promises were made good on last night at the White House. President Barack Obama said on the campaign trail, you may recall, that no one should graduate from a university without having read poetry. He also promised he would open up the White House to a wide range of people. And last night, there was both a diverse crowd and a poetry jam. One of the guests and readers was Joshua Brandon Bennett, who performed last night. He joins us from a studio in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
So take me there, buddy. Take me there. I want to hear how you sounded last night and call it out to all the people in our audience here on The Takeaway.
Okay.
Here we go. This is a segment from the poem I did last night entitled Tamara's Opus. It is only now I see that I was never willing to put in the extra effort to love her properly. So as the only person in my family who was not fluent in sign language, I have decided to take this time to apologize to Tamara. I am sorry for my silence. But true love knows no frequency. And so I will use these hands to speak volumes that can never be contained within the boundaries of sound waves. I will shout at the top of my fingertips until digits dance and relay these mental messages directly to your soul. I know that there is no poem that can make up for all the time we have lost. So please, if you can, just listen as I play you a symphony on the strings of my heart, made for no other ears on this earth but yours.
Wow.
Oh, that is
nice. I got the chills, man.
Joshua Brandon Bennett, spoken word poet who works with Youth Speaks, a nonprofit organization in Northern California, was at the White House Poetry Jam last night, along with Spike Lee, James Earl Jones, obviously Michelle Obama was there. Who else was in the house? I sound like such a dork, but who else was there in the White House last night?
Oh, man, I met a lot of great folks. Zach Braff, who actually... you know, worked on Garden State, which is one of my favorite movies. So that was pretty amazing to get the chance to see him.
Did the president and first lady seem to be entertained, seem to really enjoy what was going on?
Oh, no, they were certainly locked in. Like, I made direct eye contact with both Madam President and Barack, you know, several times. And so it was absolutely amazing to see how focused they both were on their performances.
Well, they're in the studio with you, and joining us now is Jeff Chang, hip-hop journalist and author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, which is an award-winning narrative history of hip-hop, and he's a judge at Youth Speaks. Jeff, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Culturally, how significant do you think this moment was last night and the possibility of many more moments like this? Do you think it's a kind of a 21st century Camelot moment, it seemed to me.
It's huge. I mean, it's really the sound and the shape and the texture of the new American majority in a lot of respects. That's the way I see it. You know, you've got all of these young voices who literally, you know, can speak now from the highest platform in the world. And it's just an incredible validation of young voices and new voices and diversity in this country.
Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
How you doing, Farai?
It's always good to talk to you. You know, am the most jealous person in America right now because I wasn't there last night.
That sounded like fun.
Going to bed to wake up early for the radio. And it just strikes me that, you know, you have written so much about hip-hop culture in your award-winning book, Can't Stop, Won't Stop. And I understand your next book is going to tackle the kind of multiculturalism you're talking about. But also, you've been someone who's really looked at arts policy. So just from a more political perspective, what does it mean for the government to invest in the arts?
You know, we've been talking a lot about this, and in fact, there was the first meeting of a bunch of community arts advocates, artists, folks from arts organizations that are doing great work around the country yesterday with the Obama's Office of Public Engagement. James Cass, who runs Youth Speaks and Brave New Voices, was there in the audience as well, and spoke quite a bit to the folks from the White House who are working on these types of policies. Understand that we're going to hear about who the new NEA chair is today. It's going to be officially announced, and I think that there's a lot of excitement at the grassroots level to try to figure out a way that artists can be involved in the recovery of this country, both in terms of civic society, civic engagement, as well as, obviously, the economic stimulus. You know, we're all there at the forefront of this type of stuff. And I think that for the first time in a lot of ways, artists are being recognized as workers and that, you know, people are beginning to understand that creativity is what sort of kept communities strong. It's the glue that keeps people together. And so we're looking for a lot of really interesting movement around those issues over the next 4 years.
Well, there's a long history here, and both of you are a part of it. I mean, whether we're talking about Walt Whitman, a poet in the mid-1800s, who was very much involved in formulating the voice of America. If you want to talk about the Depression and how many artists and writers were involved in that, we think of artists and poets as maybe being in opposition to the established order. But there's also a strong history of poets and artists being a part of, as you say, the recovery. Joshua Bennett, where do you think you you stand in this sort of historical context of being a voice of social change at the government level, not as necessarily opposed to the government?
Oh, wow. I think I'm very interested in the idea of how Professor Robin Kelly puts it, this notion of infra-politics, like the idea that on a ground roots every day, I guess, political level, there are changes that go on. And I think that's where I see myself situated, more as along the people and just someone who's interested in the idea of not necessarily just prison reform in terms of laws and bills that are passed, but folks going and doing workshops and sitting down on a one-to-one basis with the people whose lives are changed in a very sweeping fashion by, you know, some of these governmental changes that happen. So I think that's where I see myself, and that's why I see my trajectory as a person who uses his work on an everyday basis to work with the people and the communities I live in and work with.
So just quickly, Joshua, your poem was about someone who does not speak sign language. And is that a personal experience of yours?
Yes. My older sister, Tamara, is deaf. And for the better part of my life, I haven't been able to speak any sign language at all until recently. I think right after I wrote the poem, I've actually done my best to start learning ASL. And I'll be taking an ASL class in the spring.
Wow. That's a moment.
So you'll be able to do poetry with your hands. I mean, sign language, many people argue that you should use the capital D for deaf because it's a whole community, not just
a way
of speaking. You know?
It's centered in Washington at Gallaudet University, which is one of the centers of deaf culture. So Jeff Chang, take us out. Would it have been better if it had been a poetry slam, maybe a little more competitive than this jam thing, huh?
If people want to get that poetry slam type of vibe, they can check out the Brave New Voices finale, which is coming up on HBO this weekend. And I just want to say, you know, it's a really interesting thing. We're at a moment, you know, in the 60s, artists were seen as the outsiders, and it was a way for the U.S. to kind of say, hey, you know, we allow outsiders in our country. And at this particular moment, I think artists are asked to be folks that are rebuilding the country, and I think that that's what we're going to be looking towards over the next 4 years.
Well, congratulations to both of you, Jeff Chang, hip-hop journalist, author of Can't Stop, Won't Stop, and Joshua Brandon Bennett, one of the performers last night at the White House Poetry Jam. Both joined us from Washington, D.C. Thanks, Jeff and Josh.
Well, definitely we want to hear from you. Again, it is open mic right here on The Takeaway. It's your chance to give us a rhyme, your own, someone else's.
Nobody called. I mean, a bunch of chickens.
Yeah, total chickens. I've humiliated myself. Why not you? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. And if you missed anything, we're always here. Take our podcast to go at thetakeaway.org or on iTunes. And here's your takeaway.
I feel like the experience made a man out of me. It made a black man out of me, and it connected me to a lot of people who I hadn't felt all that close to.
It's Paul Butler, author of Let's Get Free, a hip-hop theory of justice. Let's go out on a poem.
I know that there is no poem that can make up for all the time we have lost, so please, if you can, just listen as I play you a symphony on the strings of my heart.
Joshua Brandon Bennett, I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Farai Chidea. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. The Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. And by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is The Takeaway.